Hi, everybody. This is Mark Chaffardini with Go See Talk. How are you today? Hope your weekend is glorious. Hope the birds are chirping and the sun is shining and you've got a nice little earworm in your ear, some tune, some melody that's giving you a pep in your step. Thank you so much for coming back to the Go See Talk podcast experience. We're still playing with the name. It's a bit wordy, but thank you for rejoining this groove that we have every now and then. We're lucky and happy to speak to friends in the industry, people who make the stuff that we enjoy. And at the top of the list, one of our good audio friends is Mr. Tim Burden, all the way from the U and the K. Put them together, United Kingdom. Tim, how's things in your world? Glad to have you back on the show.
Hello, Mark. Good. Thank you very much. It's good to speak to you again. And thanks for the invite. Yeah, it's been, you know, a very eventful, I suppose, since we last spoke. I think, was it 10 years ago? I don't know. It was a while.
quite a few presidents, quite a few Olympics. Yeah, we talked all about your days programming theaters and doing some voice work and your legendary father. Yeah, I bet a lot more has happened. So, yeah, glad we're catching up.
Yeah, it's good. Absolutely, it is good to catch up. And yes, I mean, I suppose since we last spoke, there's been a few great passionate projects I've been very fortunate to be involved in. The Leonard Bernstein at 100, you know, there was a big centenary celebration, right, his legacy and his contribution to the world. And it was a thrill to be able to put on a live concert, kind of, well, one of his most favorite famous concert films was his performance in 1973, and it was a real thrill to be able to present that to an audience. You know, actually put the film on in the cathedral, you know, largely big screen. We had speakers positioned carefully so it wasn't going to, you know, be too much, because obviously a cathedral is very echoey. And Sir Humphrey Burton, CBE, was kindly there in attendance. He's still thriving, thankfully, at the grand old age of 91. And he came and introduced it. And it was a wonderful event. You know, it was a very, very special event, because it was one of those kind of concert films I grew up with. You know, as soon as I saw that basically reaffirmed my love, you know, for Mahler and for film, because, I mean, it's one of these concerts which is so beautifully filmed. I recommend you see it if you can. Do you know the film I'm talking about?
No, not really, not at all. Please elaborate.
Well, no, what I'll do, no, I'll send you a link, but Mahler's Resurrection Symphony, which is one of his, you know, most famous symphonies, is like 90 minutes of a massive sound, you know, chorus, full orchestra. And it's a great, it's a symphony dedicated, I suppose. It's very apocalyptic. I mean, it's, you could say there's religious overtones to it, but essentially it's a symphony which is dedicated to the world, you know, to love. Mahler was very much, you know, connected to nature and a great love and passion, which he really poured into his music. So that was a big project, you know, that was certainly lovely to be involved in. Royal Albert Hall in 2017, just the year before, that was a dream project as well, you know, to be able to produce and present a concert in the Royal Albert Hall with the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra and with a friend of mine, Mark Silk, and Stephen Bell was conducting. That was, that was a real pinch yourself moment, you know, actually being on the Royal Albert Hall stage presenting the music from Star Wars. It was called Symphonic Star Wars, and it was just a total thrill. I mean, you're very familiar with the Star Wars music, and you know how exciting it is to hear that live in concert, don't you?
Oh, absolutely. One of the joys that I had was Richard Kaufman, a mutual friend, got the exclusive or the proprietary notes for the last the Jedi Steps, I think that's what it is, from the Force Awakens. John Williams' private collection, and played it at the Dallas Symphony when he was taking the music of John Williams throughout the country. So yeah, it is, you know, just a few bars of that, or really any score that you hold dear can really move you. Going back 100 years for Leonard Bernstein or Eric Korngold or heck, even Russell Garcia. Just, you know, I love the way music moves you, and it's so great that audiences are now able to hear it. But speak to us about how the logistics of getting people out of their houses, and, you know, now that we're through the pandemic, what's that like, getting live players together in big halls and people back together?
Well, yeah, I mean, I've done two events this year, which are, I mean, they have been John Williams related. I mean, that's the passion, as you well know. So it's always a thrill to share that passion with audiences in a concert hall. And at the start of the year, the Ulster Orchestra in Belfast, so put on a big 90th birthday, you know, celebration concert for John Williams. It was about a week and a half before his actual birthday on the 8th of February. And we even got, you know, I got the audience to kind of sing happy birthday. And, you know, I filmed it and I sent it to his manager. So it was quite a nice thing just to hear the whole, there was 2,500 people in the hall. So it was nice to hear them all sing, and lovely to get that on film. I'll send that to you actually, just for your eyes only.
Excellent,
it was
excellent.
A nice thing to do. And so that was, thankfully, I mean, lockdown had eased. And by the end of January this year, you know, the masks were still being worn in concert halls, yes. But thankfully, social distancing had eased. So the hall was able to be full, you know. And obviously, you know, the steps were taken to be precautious. There was, you know, the PCR test, you know, make sure there's no spreading of the disease. You know, if you've had any COVID in the past 7 to 14 days, you know, obviously you weren't allowed to be in the venue. So there was strict adherence to that. But you know, the audience really lapped it up. I mean, the opening piece was Superman, the movie, you know, the famous Superman March by John Williams. And it's really hard to describe how, you know, the atmosphere in that concert hall was. I mean, it was so palpable. I mean, there was a genuine kind of warmth, excitement, and kind of a relief that they were finally hearing music of that, you know, that caliber in a concert hall again, you know, in the first time essentially in about 2 years. And that was really something special. And then in Dublin, just a few weeks later, with Richard Kaufman and the National Symphony Orchestra of Ireland, again, the audience just lapped it up. That music is just so resonant in a concert hall. It's made for the concert hall because it's so richly composed and well orchestrated. It bounces off every single wall in, you know, the best possible way.
Oh, certainly. And so what were, you know, I know that you have a fondness for Empire of the Sun, the John Williams score. What were some of the standouts of the embarrassment of riches that is his catalog? What were some of the cues that you were most happy to hear?
Oh, heck, let me see. In Belfast, there was Fiddler on the Roof, the selections from Fiddler on the Roof, which John Williams put together many years ago for the Boston Pops. So the leader of the orchestra, Tamás, really relished playing that. And that was lovely to hear now live on stage. It really was. I'd never heard that live. And it was so well timed because the La La Land Records release, you know, the 3-CD Fiddler on the Roof album, beautifully remastered with extra music, had just literally been released, you know, a few weeks before, and the 50th anniversary of the film as well. So that was quite significant hearing that live. And in flipping to Dublin then a few weeks later, Summon the Heroes. And I remember hearing that live for the first time in 1996 in London, whenever John Williams came over to perform it with the London Symphony Orchestra. It was just incredible. And then being able to hear that piece live again all those years later, just in February this year, that was definitely something. It's all, you know, all guns blazing, as they say. You know, do you remember the piece, Summon the Heroes? Are you familiar?
Yeah, actually I did. I listened to that when I was in college. That was one of the songs that were shared through my peer-to-peer community at college. But it's fast. Like, you know, sometimes artists or musicians can get pigeonholed, but just it's amazing the breadth and talent that he has to be able to do this. And I mean, he's done what, 3 or 4 different Olympic fanfares?
Yes, three. So the Olympic, 1984 Olympic fanfare and theme, the Winter Olympics in 1988. Oh, it's on four, actually. Yes, sorry, 1988 Winter Olympics, the Atlanta Centennial Games in 1996, and then the Utah Simply. Yeah, it was the Winter Olympics, Call of the Champions was, what, 2002, I think. So it was, yeah, there's four. He's done four so far. So who knows? Let's hope he remains to make a kind of tidy fifth at some point. He loves that, of course, the heroic fifth. That's one of his favorite, it's one of his favorite kind of musical signatures, you know.
Yes, as is, I believe there's a phrase he likes to use called super prestissimo, which means basically as fast as possible. And I was having a conversation with Don Davis, who actually, I believe he worked on Jurassic Park 3. He's a famous orchestrator and done The Matrix. But I said, you know, aside from you and Peter Doyle and Henry Jackman, I said, you three get the most out of the string section. And he goes, no, just stop. John Williams gets the most out of any string section. I go, well, yeah, but that's kind of a given. So John just, just master. I wonder, I'm not a composer. I'm not a musician myself, but I just wonder as an architect, I have an idea of what a building is going to look like when it's done and the little pieces that make up the core and the adornments and the window dressings. But just, I always wonder what goes on in a musician's head. Is it all there when they're starting? Does, you know, and some things happen so fast that I can't process how every little flourish of a flute or a clarinet or a blast of a horn, how all those things are processed to the point where when you're putting this puzzle together, you say, I need 20 seconds of intense string work and it's got to sound like this, and how you convey that to a player. It blows my mind.
It's such a talent. It is. And I know what you mean. I think one of the things I love about watching Richard Kaufman rehearse with an orchestra, and I know other conductors do it too, but I like the way Richard does it because he really makes the orchestra listen to each other, you know, each other, each section. He splits them up, and he may have done this whenever you saw him in Dallas. He gets the violas to play. The violas often feel left out, so that, you know, that was special for them. And then, like, the, you know, the woodwinds, the brass, percussion, every section, he would often just basically single them out. So then they play it. And then, of course, for us as the listener, I mean, the phrase Richard uses, which I love, is he says, you know, with John Williams' music, certainly, you know, he likens it to like a busy subway. You know, the main driving theme is above the subway, but then beneath the subway, where all the trains and all the people are scuttling around, that, you know, the full orchestration, that's what everyone else is doing. You know, the violas, the piccolos, you know, the percussion, even the triangle, you know, they're all busy. They're so busy. While there's a main theme, surely beneath that theme, there's such a massive city of clever orchestration, you know?
Well, I'm glad you said that. Well, first of all, I've never heard that him describe that, but that almost makes me think of, did he come up with this mindset around the time he scored Earthquake or maybe even Towering Inferno? Because what's great about Earthquake is there's all these little beats and beeps, but it's also overlaid with a bit of a city soundscape. So while it's not a subway, it still feels like you're in a bustling metropolis via some source sound effects. Just amazing stuff. I don't know where we were going to go with that, except when Richard was in town recently, I couldn't attend the concert, but I completely forgot that he played on the Iger Sanction as well as Close Encounters and Jaws, and he was happy enough to sign my Iger Sanction, which I think that's such an odd both movie and score.
It is. And you know, the point you make about Earthquake is very good. You know, it is, there's a hustle and bustle. There's that kind of hi-hat percussion, which is, yeah, it signifies the kind of hustle and bustle, certainly of the city. And, you know, the rhythmic punctuations of the brass. And, you know, it's also very much steeped in that kind of jazz sensibility that's inherent with John Williams. You know, whenever he was playing in a jazz band, or whether he was orchestrating for other composers, or being a jazz pianist, he really has a gift for that kind of rhythmic sensibility and you know, the driving rhythm. I mean, you know, think of the percussion in The Lost World and Minority Report, and so many, you know, obviously the Star Wars films are a given. And, you know, there are some very clever, you know, the Coruscant chase and Attack of the Clones, really clever rhythmic variations. And, it, you know, that's, you definitely had a real gift for that. You know, totally is, you know, it's worth making that point. And the Eiger Sanction, it's a very unusual score and film, but what I like about it is, again, yes, there's that kind of jazz mood to it, but there's also some very exciting, very thrilling moments. And there's this kind of baroque, you know, that the fuse is so delightful, you know, the guitar version and then the string version. It's just, it's almost, you know, in a sense, whenever it was done, it was quite unique, you know, back then.
Yeah, I could just picture in my head that dung 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 dung, and just on the electric guitar. And and you know what's so funny about that is it almost seemed like it was a combination of two things. It was America's answer to James Bond, but also a Western in a way, like a neo Western. But I don't know. I think that there was such a nebulous time in the late 70s and early 80s where cinema itself was trying to. But you know, of course, the blockbusters of that era. But also, what could they get away with? What drew people's attention? How crazy could ideas get? And I just had a conversation not too long ago about how the 80s were kind of an era where anything did go, and studios were willing to throw a lot of money into it. And now, no matter how much money is thrown at a project, does it baffle you that composers are always being told, you know, they always come in at the end? Not always. There are certain relationships and agreements, but a lot of times we come in at the end, we have no money. How is there no money to do music when it's one of the essential pieces of the narrative tarp that's being woven?
Well, that can certainly be very frustrating. I know, and there's quite a few composers who do get exasperated by that. And I mean, there's also composers who in for a gig and then suddenly, a few weeks later, they'll find out they didn't get the gig, but then maybe your composer friend got the gig instead. So that's a very uncomfortable scenario, which I keep hearing happens a lot in Hollywood these days. You know, there certainly is, and there has been historically since the Golden Age, you know, ghostwriting. And of course, Max Steiner, most famously, I mean, Hugo Friedhofer wrote so much of Max Steiner's work, you know, but I mean, that's nothing against Max Steiner, because no, I mean, he was a genius, and his music is rightly legendary, but I think sometimes there's too much emphasis placed on the ghostwriting. And as long as the people get the credit they deserve, I think it's all right. But I mean, you know, when ghostwriting it does go on. I mean, there's no avoiding that, especially whenever if the composer's given a deadline to write, say, a 5-minute cue in maybe 6 hours. Then they're going to have to get some help in.
Well, yeah, I think when you think of John Carpenter, who wrote the Halloween score over 3 days, you have Michael Kamen, who wrote 90 minutes of music to Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves in 2 weeks, or even somebody like Michael Giacchino, who replaced Alexandre Desplat for Rogue One. I think he had to write his score I'm maybe making this up, 5 days. It's just incredibly rushed. Or even like when Pirates of the Caribbean jettisoned Alan Silvestri's work, and then they brought on Hans Zimmer and Steve Jablonski and Klaus Badelt, and it was just a whirlwind to get finished. But you know, Tim, I feel like we could just go into this geeky dialogue for days. You were talking, you know, you talk about ghostwriting, and not to say that it's exposing the work of someone else in lieu of the person you think is doing the work. What it actually really says is just, like you said, as long as somebody gets the credit. Now, what I love about, I used to listen to your radio show, Tim Burton Screen Sounds, and I loved all of the people that you would highlight, and it would be thanks to La La Land and your connections with them, but I would learn about Benjamin Wallfish and other artists I'd never heard of, but who are equally talented as the people getting the big gigs like the Fast series or the Star Wars or something like that. So I guess what went into making your show? How did you develop these relationships with La La Land, and how do you focus on these up and coming composers?
Well, let me see. I'll try and give you a good answer. Well, the Movie Magic started back in 2005, and then I suppose it was always, the intention was always to, you know, put a bit of focus and shine a spotlight on some, you know, composers' recognition as they should. And in addition as well, you know, certainly musicians, I would have brought in, you know, some of the musicians and, you know, producers, because, you know, as a very famous, the head of Paramount Music, Randy Spendlove, you know, he said this to me once in an interview. He said, you know, for a film score, basically, to make a film score happen, you need a small village of people. And he's right. I mean, it's not just the orchestra. It's so many. I mean, there's so many people behind the scenes that maybe just don't get as much credit unless you stay and watch the end credits of a film. And even then, sometimes I think people get missed. You know, it was always something. And then obviously working for Film Score Monthly online, it was in the early days, the magazine, the print magazine, just it wasn't selling anymore. So it basically had to go to an online magazine. And one of the earliest things that was nice to be part of that, I suppose, initiation was just to really, you know, give audio content, because I just, as a film music enthusiast and lover, I mean, I just found it more interesting sometimes to actually listen to the composers as opposed to read the text. And not just because I have terrible attention, no focus.
Guilty.
but also, it was just nice to hear their voices. And it was a great excuse as well to kind of weave the music in and out of them speaking and, you know, rights and you know, reuse fees. That was trickier back then in kind of the late, mid to late 2000s. Nowadays, thankfully, it's not quite as tricky to have music as long as it's kind of fair use, you know. So that was, I think it was really always that kind of mission. It was just really to get the music out there, play as much as it's possible, whether it be on radio. You know, certainly establishing relationships was, it's always good. I mean, you want composers and musicians to trust you. And I would always, you know, let them hear the interview first. And if there's something they didn't like or something, you know, maybe was wrong with the edit or maybe they regretted, you know, it's not really in my interest as I wouldn't consider myself a journalist, you know, in that respect. So I would always let them, you know, let them kind of sign off on it, really, because it's not really of any interest to annoy people, you know, you want to do good by. So that was always really, I suppose, my intention. And at the end of the day, that was always me growing up. I mean, with, you know, the love of music was certainly from my parents, and being in that kind of world and accompanying dad to, whether it be sessions or whether it be to Trinity College of Music in London, as a young boy, you know, I would have accompanied him whenever he was teaching students. And I'll never forget just the smells and, you know, of the corridors and the noise of the kind of weird cacophony of sounds coming from different rooms. You know, you had a piano in the room beside you, and then you heard an oboe just down the corridor. It was this weird kind of, well, it was a lovely noise, but I mean, it's almost surreal thinking back. And I think that's why I love always spending so much time with orchestras and at rehearsals, because it kind of brings me back to that time as a kid where I just soaked up as much music and as much education from the musicians as well as the repertoire of what they were playing.
Well, Tim, why don't we talk about La La Land record turns 20 this year. How did you first get in touch with them? Did you, and kind of what established the relationship and how you're able to help? Because what I love learning is hearing Matt Verbois talk about his efforts to put these special releases together. And just curious how that's expanded over the years.
Is one of the nicest guys in the business, and as is Michael Gerhardt. They're both, you know, I suppose the passion is certainly shared. You know, they deliver what the film music enthusiasts want, and that's always a good, it's a good mindset. And, you know, at the end of the day, they're very much of, I suppose, our generation, Mark, you know, I mean, although I think you're a bit younger, so I'll give you that, sorry. But they're certainly, they're like-minded. And, you know, I first started speaking to them, I mean, let me see, it must have been during the early days, I suppose, of the movie Magic Show. And just, you know, because the label was really only starting out in the mid to late 2000s. So similar time as I was kind of trying to get the show out, and also the Film School Monthly features too. And then working with Eric Woods, Cinematic Sound, it was great, you know, getting as much music from them, you know, on his show. And their releases have got so much better over the years. I mean, certainly Jim Titus and his artwork is stunning. Dan Goldwasser and his art, and certainly Mike Matesino and his work in restoring the audio is just second to none. It's always a joy the professionals talk about their work for the labels. Obviously, I know, you know, it can be a minefield getting the licensing and getting all the rights signed off, and, you know, there can be literally hundreds of emails back and forth with certain people and just trying to get approvals and trying to get things signed off. I mean, that is just, again, it's one of those cases of the nature of the industry. But with La La Land Records, yeah, they really have gone from strength to strength. And 20 years, absolutely. I mean, it would be about right, 20 years, early 2000s. And the leading soundtrack label out there. And as much as I like the other guys, I think they just have something a little bit extra special. You know, and as I said, Matt and Michael are just great guys. I mean, I've recently been able to actually work on a more, I suppose, administrative level. I mean, I helped with the release of Far and Away a couple of years ago, consulting with Mike Matesino on, you know, some of the historical aspects. And I suppose the Irish connection was maybe a nice thing to utilize. And then Fiddler on the Roof recently. And it's been, yeah, I mean, it's certainly, I suppose, because of the work I do with Maurizio on the Legacy of John Williams website, it's a kind of perfect marriage, really, to be able to work. Yeah, I mean, I suppose primarily the John Williams release, but some of the other releases too, and mindset of wanting to do right by the music, wanting to promote the music and get people to visit their website and buy the music. And, you know, even recently at concerts in Dublin and in New York, we've been trying to actually sell the CDs in the concert hall foyers, hopefully more in the coming months. I mean, I know people keep saying no one buys CDs anymore, but once you've come out of a concert and you're incensed by that wonderful music, then what's wrong with buying, you know, an album from the composer you've just heard? I mean, it's like if you're going to see one of your favorite rock stars, you know, there's merchandise stalls, aren't there? So there's certainly room for that. So that's been nice to try and do a bit of that with La La Land, and just to get their music, I suppose, get more awareness, because, you know, they're a specialist label at the end of the day, but the potential there to cross over to the kind of general populace is huge. I mean, Classic FM and Lyric FM in Dublin, they've been programming some music from La La Land Records. Also in Sharda, I should mention in Sharda too. Space Camp, you know, their new release is tremendous, and that's going to be on Classic FM. So it's been a joy, I think, just to try and get their music basically heard beyond the film music fan. Just trying to get it out beyond the network to the larger audience. That's a really long-winded answer, Mark. I mean, I'm sorry. I hope that makes sense.
No, it does. It does. And you know, it's what I really like about the label is that yes, we're in an era where CDs have kind of fallen out of vogue, but and honestly, I bought a car about 3-4 years, 5 years ago, and it did not have a CD player. I was really excited about bringing my, and yes, I still have a binder of my favorite soundtracks and scores.
Yeah.
I brought it into the car and I was looking around the dashboard and I go, oh dear Lord, there is no CD player. So now I had to, you know, rip everything on and just put it onto a thumb drive. Totally boring side story, but yeah, I'm looking through my drawer right now. I have Batman from La La Land, Batman Returns, Inner Space, Big Trouble Little China,
yes.
The brand new, let's see, the Robin Hood Prince of Thieves, Dances with Wolves, Kingsman, Home Alone, Hook, goes on and on. And so, yes, I feel that they, much like Varese and much like Entrada, even though CDs have a kind of, let's just say, a pocket audience, and now that cars don't let you port them as much as they used to, I still feel that they are for the fans. Whereas even though I've taken to vinyl and bought into that, vinyls, I would still say it's a bit of a fad, but real audiophiles would go all out for a CD, especially because it's cleaner and, you know, the liner notes are spectacular. I mean, there's like 30 pages in the Hook special edition. So it really, they go all out to really connect with their audience. I'm thankful to be, to have learned who they are.
Yes. Yeah, no, you're right. And, you know, there was an interview which I imagine you probably heard some years ago. They were quite interesting, actually, to hear them talk about how, like, the 1990s for them was so difficult to get elements. So many of the scores were, there was DAT tapes being used. For some reason, it was easier to find analog elements than DAT elements. So that was quite fascinating. But, you know, and you talked about Mondo earlier, you know, just before we started recording, just off air. And, you know, Mondo have employed Mike Mattesino recently to do work for him. And, you know, they've used the La La Land record kind of benchmark when it comes to artwork and liner notes. And Mike did a wonderful job on Jaws, the Mondo release of Jaws a few years ago, which John Williams himself actually sent a note to Mike saying how much he loved the booklet notes. I mean, and what a lovely praise to receive from the man himself.
Oh, amazing. I didn't know that. That's fantastic.
Wasn't it? Wonderful. Yeah. And that Jaws release is so, so wonderfully put together. And, you know, even the name of it is so cool. You know, the shark, the music is still working.
Right.
The name is of his little essay, which I thought was quite cool. And of course, Hook, yes, Hook is coming out in June. And the great John Tekis has written the liner notes for that. But Mike Mattesino has been very much involved in the audio side of that for Mondo. So that, similar to Home Alone a few years ago, it's really lovely to have, I think, these scores presented like that with vinyl. You know, and La La Land Records have done it themselves with E.T. and Saving Private Ryan.
Yes, yeah. And Schindler's List, yeah. I think, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, I'm not a huge fan of orchestral music on vinyl because it, you know, it highlights all the, you know, the kind of detriments of, if you want a quiet bit of music, you can hear the record noise. So I'm not really a fan of that, but I certainly love the packaging and the effort with the, you know, the booklet. And it's lovely to be able to hold this massive kind of gatefold and deluxe booklet, which is so much more impressive than a CD booklet, because obviously it's bigger. So it's just one of those, I suppose it's aesthetics, isn't it? But I mean, it's something which, yeah, it probably is a fad, but then again, I mean, some people are making tapes, you know, cassette tapes of certain things. I can't see any benefit to that at all, but there you go.
No, I'm on the same page. I think to use a very modern colloquial, mental. It is mental. Like, you can't go back that far. I understand the allure to it, but really, I mean, having a working CD player in a car is reasonable to assume, but having a working tape deck, I just don't know if that's, it just sits on your shelf more than that does anything else. But
no, I know. And I don't know if you're, do you remember, like, I remember the days where the tape would actually unspool and it would be a nightmare to try and put it back together again. And it would get caught in the tape deck and it would be like, oh no, the music's ruined. But
I do remember that.
You do, right?
Yeah, I heard a comedian say, or no, not a comedian. I heard somebody on Twitter. They wrote, why would you listen to records? You're playing a media that literally gets worse every time you spin it. When the CDs are meant to be pristine. But yeah, you have that entire, I mean, talk about going tits up with a tape when it unspools, because there's a, what was it? Mark Maron had this great bit about the uniqueness of a cassette, and it's this hysterical long-winded thing about Lynyrd Skynyrd.
Well, yeah, sure. I mean, look, Maurizio Cassetto in Italy, this is very much his baby, and it's a wonderful project. And I started assisting him with it early in its conception. And then he kindly invited me to be part of it as on a more kind of official basis as head contributor, which is, it's just been wonderful to be able to kind of build on the project, which is, it's not just a tribute page. It is very much an educational resource. I mean, we've been speaking with the people closest to John Williams, and they remember so much more than the great maestro does himself, you know, to be totally honest with you. I mean, because essentially, like any composer, you move on to each project, and sometimes you just don't have the capacity to remember as much as, say, a musician who's laboring their love on music for 2 weeks of sessions, or, you know, it could be longer, or whether it be, you know, sound engineers or certainly performers. You know, we've been very fortunate to interview people like, you know, the London Symphony Orchestra. We interviewed the head of artistic planning, Sue Mallett, along with some of the musicians last year. Also Sir Clive Gillinson, who manages Carnegie Hall. Well, he used to manage the LSO after being a cellist in the orchestra. I mean, Sue Mallett, decades, very much there from, you know, day one, whenever Williams was working with them, and in the late 70s, you know. So it was wonderful to hear such stories. I mean, a great story from Sue, and I mean, she really just emphasized the genius of John Williams and how clever he was in establishing the Hal Leonard signatures. The fundamental reason of him doing that is John Williams has a fear of takedowns. There's no problem doing a different, say, you know, an arrangement for piano and cello, like obviously he would himself do that. But whenever orchestras in the 80s and 90s were really making ropey rearrangements of his music, he loathes that. So establishing the Hal Leonard signature series, you know, the John Williams signature series, was just genius. And because he, you know, orchestras have the music there, they have from the man himself. It's what he wants orchestras to play in, you know, his eyes and obviously ears. And it's clever. So just the man is just steeped in musicality and a sincere care for the art and for performers to be doing it the right way, I guess, you know. So yes, but to answer your original question, yes, the legacy of John Williams, we've got some great projects coming. You know, we talked about some of the heroes earlier. They made the original recording back in 1996 with Tim Morrison flying high with that wonderful trumpet solo, and we'll be speaking with Tim along with other members of the Boston Symphony and Boston Pops. And so that'll be a nice video kind of project, similar to the London Symphony one we did last year. And we'll have some sound engineers, Simon Rose, the legendary Abbey Road engineer who worked on so many James Horner scores, but also he mixed Angela's Ashes and the Harry Potter scores for Harry Potter 1 and 2 with John Williams, and he also worked on some of the Sony classical albums back in the late 90s. So it'll be nice to speak to Simon Rhodes. And so, yeah, I mean, look, the legacy of John Williams is, as I said, it's very much Maurizio's baby, but it's been lovely to work with him. And we've got Mike Mattesino actually speaking with us very soon as well about his work on Space Camp and Presumed Innocent, which is expanded as well. Both, you know, two expanded special John Williams scores, which are always, you know, good to hear. Some people don't like to hear, to have the complete versions, but I mean, I don't see any problem with it at all, because why not? If the music is there, it was written, there was a lot of love put into the music, so why not have it all on the album? It makes perfect sense.
Yeah, I can't argue with that. And I've actually spoken to some composers who are befuddled that people would want to listen to, you know, 4 hours of something when it really doesn't, whether it's a transition between a scene or just something that really doesn't have a lot of narrative weight. But, you know, there's fans for literally everything out there. And when it comes to film fans, they're some of the most fervent and rabid. So let's give them what they want.
Absolutely. Yeah. Don't point back.
Yeah. Well, Tim, I tell you what, yeah, if you could furnish us with some of those dates and release information or whatever you can, we'll put it on the site and include it in this post. But for now, I really want to thank you for spending some time with us on a Sunday. And why don't you take us out? Tell us where listeners can find your personal things you're passionate about. Throw some websites at us.
All right, Mark. Well, once again, thanks so much for inviting me on your brilliant show. It's always a pleasure to speak with you and, you know, to catch up after all these years. Thank you for your work in certainly in the film music world, for promoting it on such a great website. Well, look, if you want to find out a bit about me, then yes, timburden.com. But the projects, yeah, will be at thelegacyofjohnwilliams.com. You know, my radio show, Movie Magic, goes out on Belfast247onair.com every Thursday and Sunday night between 7 and 9 p.m. And then, yeah, I mean, occasionally on BBC Radio Ulster, but that's kind of now and again. But FSM Online is certainly a great film music resource. So if you go to fsmonlinemag.com, then I'm sure you'll find something to appreciate.
I love it. Sounds magical. Well, everyone, please check out Tim's work, Tim's projects, and we will catch you next time.